Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we have Dr. Ailey Cohen here to talk to us about environmental toxins, the havoc they can wreak on our body and our brains, but most importantly, what we can do to protect ourselves. She's the author of Integrative Environmental Medicine. It's a fascinating conversation. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, and functional medicine and mindset. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is my new friend, Dr. Ailey Cohen. Dr. Cohen is a rheumatologist, integrative medicine specialist, and environmental health expert practicing in Princeton, New Jersey. She's the author of Integrative Environmental Medicine, published through Oxford University Press, and the soon-to-be-released Non-Toxic Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World, which will be out in September 2020. Dr. Ailey Cohen, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad we connected because environmental toxins is such an important and timely topic. And even things that we wouldn't think of, you know, it's often like the water situation in the world, like not having healthy water. We think of it as like an issue with Flint, Michigan, or something in Africa or somewhere
it's
else
them,
in the world.
Not
it's
us.
Them
yeah.
And not us.
Yeah.
And yet actually we're all being affected. There's so many Flint, Michigans that are out there, maybe one right around for where some of our listeners are, and we're going to jump into water. But first, I'd love to give a little bit of a background on how you came to this place where you're so passionate about sounding the alarm when it comes to environmental toxins and the impact they're having on our health. So in 2006, your dog became gravely ill. Tell us that story and how it relates to the work that you're doing today.
Yeah, I think, well, to begin with, I laugh pretty much every day thinking how I got here because the journey was pretty remarkable. So starting back, I guess in 2006, I had two little kids and I had a beautiful dog, Truxton, Sir Commodore Truxton. And he got really sick and he was all of 4.5 years old, golden retriever, and my firstborn, so to speak. But anyway, he got really sick and we really just didn't know what was wrong with him and assumed that it was just pretty much a benign, you know, he ate a sock or something of that sort. So it turned out he had an autoimmune disease called autoimmune hepatitis. And his, you know, he ended up having a liver the size of like, you know, a golf ball by the time we figured out what it was. And what's interesting about this is I'm an autoimmune disease specialist by training. And so just it was just an incredibly sad irony. We ended up treating him as much like a human as we could, but he did pass away. And so the question really at that time was having, I think at that time I was probably eating Oreos and Cheese Whiz and, you know, drinking Diet Dr. Pepper. I really wasn't health. I was a little bit health conscious, but not terribly health conscious.
You were doing the standard thing.
Standard American diet, really just trying to survive. I think I had two young babies at the time. So, I was trying, but certainly not able to do as much as I could in terms of health and prevention. But I was wondering, why did my dog get sick? And why did he get sick with this? And it was just so heartbreaking because we love this dog so much that, you know, we kept researching. My husband's a physician, too. And so we were just kind of understanding, you know, what's the air quality in our town? How about all the farmland we live on? We live right on the corner of 200 acres of farmed land in New Jersey. What about his drinking water? You know, what could be in there? And then we thought, of course, about food and treats and whether they could have been contaminated. So there was a lot of questions we had, and it, as I was looking through all these topics and trying to figure out what could have possibly affected his immune system, switched his immune system to affect himself, to go after his own body, his own liver, you know, I learned so much about human health and exposures and how they're so limited. There's limited regulation policy regarding human health exposures in this country and around the world. Air quality, water quality, the chemicals on fabrics, the chemicals in, you know, food packaging and in our food. And, you know, certainly water has risen to the top for me over the last 6 years as sort of a really key issue that no one's paying attention to. So,
and it's kind of crazy because often dogs and humans get the same diseases.
We are more and more now.
We are more and more now because our lifestyles are similar. And we're going to be talking a little bit about that. And some zoo animals, too, who are in artificial environments, but animals that are living in the wild, like wolves, don't get these same diseases exactly. Maybe there's some environmental exposures that are there. So what can you remember being one of the big aha moments? You know, I'm sorry to hear about your dog and everything that Truxton had gone through, but what was the first time that you made that connection to your own health when you were reading some of this literature and material, and what were some of the changes you started to make in your own health?
So fortunately at the time I was pretty healthy. I was thinking more about my patients. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about some of the things and, you know, I was experiencing with patients complaining about health issues, their autoimmune issues, rheumatoid, you know, I see a lot of rheumatoid, I see lupus, certainly see a bunch of other neurodegenerative diseases like MS, in my practice. So that kind of alarmed me because of the volume of who I was seeing as patients and then sort of seeing these connections in my reading between these environmental exposures. But I realized pretty quickly the sort of the unnecessary exposures that I was having, or, you know, without thinking about them, you know, sort of not knowing that, for instance, air fresheners really don't freshen the air. They actually, you know, do the opposite. They're contaminants. They get on our flooring and our furniture. They get in our lungs, you know, essentially. Why do we need them? Why are we marketed to kind of keep up with the Joneses? And, you know, how about all those lawn chemicals? Do we really need them? Do we really care about all those chemicals that might be sprayed on lawns to make our you know, lawns look flawless? You know, and then, of course, there's always changing out products to safer versions. You know, the concept that you can actually have a choice in what you purchase is a remarkable one, because we can move the consumer product market in a safer direction should we choose to. And really, we're seeing that in the market.
You know, I think that one of the things is on Instagram, I post a lot in stories about different up-and-coming studies and things that are out there. There was one just the other day talking about how a lot of non-organic tea brands that have their tea sachet made in plastic,
yes,
are exposing people to millions of microplastics that, mm-hmm, are there. Mm-hmm. And the estimate, I think, is that most humans, adult humans living in America, have about like five grams of plastic a week, depending on what they're exposing themselves to. So I share these things online and I talk about different, hey, this is the pesticides that might be in our food. And sometimes people DM me and they say, dude, okay, everything's bad. We can't do, it's in a way overwhelming and it can be a little bit depressing. Take us a little bit back and help us understand, how do we get into this mess where we have to worry so much about so many different things? Like, an air freshener seems so harmless and yet it's something that we have to worry about. A tea bag seems so harmless, but it's something that we have to think about. How did we get to this space in society?
It's a great question, because, you know, I was on a journey and trying to figure out, how much do I have to freak out about and how much do I just take seriously? How much of my daily habits can I clean up without much effort? So it kind of goes back to why I started a platform called The Smart Human. I was frustrated and I felt, if I am trying to learn this information on my own, why am I not sharing it with people, everyday people, and eventually school children and education work. The Smart Human was kind of designed to give people information, but also say, here's what you do about it. Here's a reasonable way to handle the problem without flipping out, without spending tons of money, without even making a lot of effort. A lot of it is just avoidance, and to know why you should avoid something or not buy it.
And before we even get into that, I'll even take it a little bit, sorry to interrupt,
yeah,
you.
No.
A lot of people sort of, the subtext under their question is, you know, my grandparents lived to like 90 years old or 80 years old, and they weren't worried about all this,
right,
stuff. I think we're just freaking out. So what has happened in our landscape,
yeah,
whether it's government or the chemicals that are out there, that is actually maybe part of some of the reason why we have to pay attention to these things that our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents didn't have to think about?
Well, a lot of this, you know, chemical development really took off after World War II. And so that's when we really got all these new chemicals, and we were marketed to, you know, better living through chemistry, which is what Monsanto is known for.
Which is a lot of those companies also, they were making products that were, you know, used in wars, could be bombs, could be different ingredients that are used there. And when the war ended and the machinery that sort of big industrial war machine stopped, those same chemical companies were like, okay, what's the next application of our factories and what we're up to?
Right. So a lot of the chemicals they came up with actually added to human quality of life and shelf stability of food and, storage of food, reduction of, resources, natural resources. So by having some of these chemicals and making plastics and cans for storage, there was actually a strong initial move forward to keep creating these chemicals for human convenience. Plastic dishes instead of having to, wash dishes. This was a big sell in the 1950s. But what ended up happening with a lot of good things that happened in the world is that no one really sees the end point. No one sees sort of how much this could get out of hand and where's the stream of use all the way to, where those products and those chemicals end up. And so, like a lot of things that I discovered in this country, specifically this country as opposed to others that I can't talk about, I don't know the ins and outs, is that we do a lot of putting things out to market before doing proper testing. When it comes to personal care products, for instance, nothing is regulated. There is absolutely no regulation in terms of chemicals that are put into cleaning products. Personal care products, products that we use on our skin, products that we use internally, like feminine care products, which is a big issue. Considering how many tampons and feminine care products women use in a lifetime, this is an enormous amount of exposure. And back to your question of sort of why should we care, the science reveals that even small amounts of exposure cumulatively over time adds up. Because many of these chemicals can affect the normal workings of the human body, particularly the endocrine system.
And I want to talk about the endocrine system in a second. And when companies say, this has been tested, really what they're talking about is that if they're looking at the science that's out there, they're looking at one single exposure, maybe a limited exposure. But nobody's taking into account that throughout our day, there's so many micro exposures we have, and then you live hopefully a long and beautiful life, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years old, and the accumulation of all those things together. So let's talk about the endocrine disruptors. What's an example of a product that we all use that could have certain chemicals inside of it that could be an endocrine disruptor, and what does that mean for our body?
So, for instance, many people, not everyone, has heard of a chemical called bisphenol A or BPA.
Right. That's pretty out there in the world.
Right. So BPA was, fortunately, through the work of a lot of international scientists and, of course, in this country, including my co-author for that book, were able to get bisphenol A out of sports bottles and baby bottles in 2012. The reason that chemical is a problem is because when you're giving it to in baby bottles and sports bottles by volume and the size of a baby, an infant, there was enough evidence to show that it could actually affect the endocrine system of a newborn. Unfortunately, BPA is pervasive. It's in many, many different products. It's still in every canned product, all the diet sodas and regular, so any canned drinks, any canned
in
beers.
In terms of the internal lining,
so
right?
It lines the inside of cans.
Right.
It's a very thin layer. It's a plastic layer. Essentially, BPA is a plastic or plasticizer chemical. And what it does is it's supposed to protect the interior contents of that can with the metal wall, the aluminum wall, so that there's no food contact with metals. Or at least if it gets dented, there's no contamination there. The problem is that it's very cheap to use BPA in cans. It's been a process we've been using for many, many years. The few, if any, can companies that or food companies that use cans that don't have BPA as a lining, in general, have to charge about 2 cents more per can. So there's a cost, issue there. The other issue with canned foods is that acidic foods, like tomatoes, canned tomatoes, or anything that has an acidic or even a fatty content to it tends to pull more BPA into that food product.
Because it's breaking it down.
It's breaking it down, and it's a lipophilic, meaning it likes fat. But the acid actually takes it off the side of the can. And so in real life, in real time, BPA as a chemical actually breaks down, has a half-life, what we call a half-life, in about 6 hours. So in about 6 hours after ingesting any kind of canned drink or canned food, you may have a certain level of BPA that will wash out within 6 hours, more or less, depending on the patient or the person, so to speak. The problem is that we get BPA from so many exposures during even a given day, mostly through ingestion, but certainly through dermal exposure, receipts. We have, right. Any kind of receipts have usually a BPA coating to them. So we handle receipts and airline tickets and parking tickets, really has a lot of BPA to it. We get exposed throughout the day. So what they call BPA is sort of pseudo-persistent, meaning it breaks down and it gets out of your system. And it's measured in many, many studies how people can give up canned foods. And essentially, they have much lower levels at the end of the day or even the next day. But we're also getting exposed on a regular basis. We never really lower those levels in reality.
So our body's constantly having an influx of it, and it becomes right. a permanent part of our lifestyle.
Right.
What's an example? BPA is pretty out there, and you even see people like Dr. Oz talking about, if a woman is pregnant, especially, in general, most people, yeah. if we can avoid receipts, just avoid it, right?
Well, there's practical ways to do it. People who work in industries where you're handling a lot of receipts, it's not a bad idea to either wear nitrile gloves or not vinyl, but nitrile gloves or Band-Aids on your fingertips. And there's studies that show that pregnant grocery checkout people, women, have higher levels of BPA just from exposure. So there are interesting epidemiologic studies that show that the exposure is high, but that if you want to make behavioral changes, that you can actually lower those exposures. Blood levels, essentially. Urinary levels, but blood levels of other chemicals.
So take it a little step further for our audience, because they like to dig into it. They'll follow along with you. So what is an endocrine? So the BPA gets in our system. We're right. constantly exposed to it. What is it doing now? What kind of havoc is it wreaking over a period of time on our system?
So what ends up happening is that it can mimic some of the hormones in the human body. So we have many glands in the body. So I'll name a few: thyroid gland, adrenal gland. We have our ovaries and testes in male and females. So fertility obviously is part of that picture. What happens is that if these chemicals are able to mimic the normal hormone production, function, regulation, even the receptors for these hormones, which are messengers, then we got a problem, because now they're intervening in the normal workings, the normal messaging of these chemicals throughout the body to do the normal functioning for the human body, growth and development, brain development in non-pregnant people, but also in pregnant people with, and women with young children or fetal growth. Certainly thyroid conditions are linked to many environmental exposures. Diabetes, insulin use, and weight gain, actually. Fat cells respond to BPA and many other chemicals in terms of their size and whether stem cells grow into fat cells.
And
so,
BPA is just one chemical in plastics that correct. We've done extensive, that not we, but the community.
It's sort of the mascot.
It's mascot, but there's other chemicals in plastics too, sure. that maybe we haven't really put the spotlight on that can still be endocrine disruptors. So even sometimes if you get a bottle without BPA,
right.
it's good it doesn't have BPA, and that's the first step, but there could be other things in them that could have be like xenoestrogens in the body.
Correct.
Right? So what's your recommendation for people in general who feel like, oh, this bottle's plastic, but it's BPA free? Are we in the clear?
Well, so this is where we run into problems with manufacturing in this country. So in the U.S., manufacturing has the right of way in the sense that they can label and manufacture many, whatever they want to in general, aside from, say, organic food, which actually has criteria. Anything other than organic does not. But in personal care products and other commercial and industrial products, it's proprietary what's in their chemical solutions. We have over 90,000 chemicals registered for use in products in this country. There are over 800 to 1,000 known endocrine disruptors in terms of chemicals. About 62,000, I think, were grandfathered in even before 1976, when the laws started to get a little bit more intense. But we really have no oversight when it comes to these chemicals. And so, you know, the messaging is, instead of, you know, we've only had, by the way, 5 chemicals taken off the market in this country, as opposed to, say, 1,200 in Europe.
Right, because they have the precautionary principle.
Precautionary principle. They have a different system set up for evaluating their chemicals before they go into use.
Here in the States, it's until it's proven
correct
as being harmful,
correct,
that a company pretty much has the free will to use it in any way that they want.
And if there's a problem, say, with a product, you know, a hair shampoo, which we've heard of recently with a hair company that people's hair started coming out, it's entirely up to the manufacturer to take it off the shelves. The U.S. government, the FDA, the EPA, whatever body of government, you know, that may be involved in those environmental exposures is not allowed to take those products off the, you know, off the shelf. So again, we're in this situation where, you know, we're limited as consumers in terms of what we can do from a policy standpoint, but we can do other things. We can change policy through purchasing power. We can hurt them with their wallets. And we also have enormous number of resources now, which is what I try to tell in my book and on The Smart Human, about what we can actually do to gain some of that control back on a personal and individual level to protect our bodies, to protect exposure, you know, lower exposures in our families, certainly in pregnant women, those with autoimmune diseases, people who have a more sensitive either endocrine or immune system. So, you know, I'm all about staying in my lane, trying to fight the fight that's about giving people practical information, honest, practical information, and not using scare tactics. Even though everything I'm talking about is scary, I think it's really important to make sure people are not resistant to change and understand that they can make changes that are beneficial to their health with very little cost and just, you know, some really vetted information.
Yeah, and we'll get more into the practical steps for sure. So we talked about endocrine disruptors. What's an example of another chemical that we're exposed to? And going back to your work as a rheumatologist, what's an example of a chemical that you found often is linked to some of the patients that you're trying to help improve their health?
So it's a great question again. So I'll give another example that I find kind of interesting. There are certain food washes that we use in this country. So not just pesticides, which we know are to avoid, you know, bugs on our produce, but even some food washes that are allowable before they go into, you know, production or I guess sent out to stores. One of those is called perchlorate. Perchlorate is a food wash that is allowable. I don't believe it's allowed.
When you say food wash, can you just
In other words, like
is?
A fruit and produce wash. So in other words, it's washed when it comes out of the field or
at the factory or the farm.
Exactly. And we have perchlorate in other parts. You know, it's in rocket fuel. I mean, it ends up on farms and in cows, even organic cows, because, again, it ends up on feed that that the animals eat, for instance. So we have a lot of different exposures, ways to get exposed to perchlorate. But let's just start with the food wash. Perchlorate is an endocrine disruptor. We know that it works on the thyroid gland. It likes to sit in the thyroid gland and in what's called the sodium iodide symporter. So it wants to take up the spots in the thyroid that are not already taken up by, say, iodine, which is a nutrient that we're all deficient in. So not everybody, but a good portion. It's similar to like a vitamin D or magnesium. We're not really nutrient sufficient, which is the term I like to use a lot. So as an example, I tend to, you know, check people's iodine level to see whether or not they're getting enough, because we're not getting it from our diet as much as we used to. It's not in table salt, and we don't use table salt anymore. We use sea salt, which doesn't have iodine. And so because we're not getting it in the breads and the other foods that they used to supplement it in, we're just deficient iodine. So the point being is that we have this exposure that if we know to take enough iodine, not too much, because that can cause hyperthyroid and some other issues, but if we have it monitored or checked, super cheap nutrient, super easy to fix, but it also acts as another barrier to prevention of those exposures or to the health effects of those exposures. So that's just a very specific example. Mm-hmm. But one I like to use because there's real value to knowing that information.
Yeah, you know, whenever there's an article about a latest, like, pesticide or chemical that's out there in the environment. And it's slowly starting to shift because there's so much more research that's happening in this space. They'll often find, the media will find a well-meaning, you know, doctor expert that's out there. There was an article that I was reading a few years ago. They went to a physician at NYU, and they said, you know, there's these BPAs that are in our water, mm-hmm. in our foods, in our things, you know, and their recommendation was, look, your body has its own detoxification system. It's just going to get rid of these things anyway. We don't, besides minimizing exposure, there's nothing else that we have to do. So in this example of perchlorate that's there and you paying attention to a patient's thyroid and getting enough iodine, besides minimization, let's say somebody has been living next to a field or has had a lot of exposure to these things, do they have to take it a step further and actively think about including things in their diet or lifestyle to support the detoxification process of these chemicals?
So I'll take it to, we have to live, I look at it anthropologically. Okay, so I was trained in anthropology in college. We need to have some perspective on our human existence. We have been evolving as humans for over 2.5 to 4.5 million years. These chemicals, these 90,000 chemicals that are now regulated and in all our products, all the products we love, have only been in existence in our evolution for the last 100, 150 years. So it's an enormous amount of exposure to throw on the body and expect it to acclimate and to adapt, which is what we kind of think of when we think of getting rid of things naturally. We think of all of those adaptive mechanisms that we've evolved, which we do have fabulous ones. We have a liver that works fantastically to many of the things it's adapted to get rid of. But we also have these new exposures, new chemicals that have different routes of entry, different routes of exposure, different degrees of breakdown. We also have mixtures of chemicals. So it's one thing to look at a chemical in and of itself and what it does in the lab than what it might do in an animal like a mouse or a rat, but then to look at it in a human and see all the other exposures.
Right, it's not just BPA. It's pesticides.
It's medications. It's medications. It's everything you can think of. So, you know, they're not tested in an isolated scenario, which makes it very difficult, in fact, to test clinically whether or not a chemical is actually causing. It's usually an association with an illness because there's just no way to control for all those extra factors. But when it comes to detox, and we think anthropologically, sweating, remarkably important for getting rid of a certain degree, not a large degree, but a certain degree of everyday exposures. Sauna for those who can't move at that level, who are wheelchair bound or any number of disabilities or overweight or that kind of thing. But certainly sauna is a form of sweating that doesn't require actual physical activity.
Some good data behind it in terms
data.
Of its ability to pull toxins when they look at sweat and they look at like the toxic release that's inside of there.
Exactly.
Some great data behind that.
And then also, you know, using clean water to flush these chemicals. I mean, it kind of goes back to why I was at the gym that I joined a while back, and, you know, I exercised and I went to the sauna and I was feeling really great. And I jumped in the shower and I looked at this stuff, this crappy shampoo and conditioner and body wash that was on the wall. And I thought, how did that just not defeat the purpose? You know, like I have to bring my own stuff because technically that junk is in bulk. It's refillable containers. It's generally based on cost when you have huge gyms. And here we are working so hard to do the right thing through anthropology and through this process and drinking even maybe filtered water. And then putting them back onto our body.
Right. The chemical exposure, the fragrances.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to talk about those in a second, but you talked about water. So I want to dig into water a little
bit. Sure.
So in the Environmental Working Group, which my business partner, Dr. Mark Hyman, is on the board of, reported that nearly 67%, almost two-thirds of Americans are living without a safe and healthy water supply. That's almost 200 million Americans. And for a lot of people, they're like, wait, what? I thought we have a municipality that's filtering the water. It goes through the pipes. It makes its way to my home. And America, first of all, is so privileged and lucky to have that water access that it does. So what makes this water not safe or completely safe, and how has that been changing over a period of time?
So to go upstream a little and learn about sort of the water system in our country, so we have over 160,000 wastewater treatment plants. Okay, that's where our water gets cleaned. 80% of that water that gets cleaned comes from surface bodies, you know, lakes and streams and rivers, and 20% generally comes from underground water, aquifers that travel underneath the water. Anything, any chemicals that get into the surface waters, even from the air, or get into the groundwaters through fertilizers and agribusiness and agriculture, any chemicals from industrial spills, from climate change related issues, tornadoes, hurricanes, we've seen a lot of flooding, anything that gets into those bodies of water will filter into our treatment plants that will eventually become our drinking water.
And they can't filter it out, you know, like what's going on over there?
And that's not just the end of it. I mean, we have fracking chemicals. We have coal ash, which is ash that is created after trying to take care of our energy sources, our coal energy sources. So we have a number of other exposures, including toilet water. I mean, who knew that toilet water can become our drinking water? It gets recycled back. And what's in toilet water? We have medications, antidepressants, which might not be so bad. I'm just kidding. Oral contraceptives. We have blood pressure medications, antipsychotics. I mean, these chemicals have been tested in pre-treatment water. Now the question is, well, what do those treatment plants do? I mean, what is their purpose and what do they do? They're supposed to take off a certain number of chemicals in those treatment plants held to a standard. Well, in this country, under the 1974 Safe Drinking Water Act, only 91 chemicals are actually regulated and mandated to have an upper limit of exposure or level. So when I talk about 90,000 that can get into our water and only 91 are actually really thoroughly, you know, managed at these water treatment plants, perhaps even at a level that may not be healthy, in my opinion, but certainly have a level which they cannot go higher than in terms of those chemicals. We have a real pickle.
That's a big gap, 90,000 and only 91. And they're looking for things like lead and other aspects
arsenic,
of there.
Arsenic, lead, and actually you can look it up.
Which can still end up in the water in the last mile if the pipes are, you know, the aging pipes in homes, the aging infrastructure here in Los Angeles, they're right. Replacing a bunch of pipes that have been around forever.
Yes.
So they're only looking for those 91.
In the treatment plants.
So
you're right. So when they send, I met with all these, you know, treatment plant people, and they're doing their job perfectly well. I mean, these are people that are very good at their job. They have all the screens up. They're managing for bioterrorism. They're managing for different levels. But when the water leaves that water treatment plant, and by the way, the infrastructure is so outdated that it can't handle the majority of the chemicals that have been newly created since the time that those treatment plants were set up.
Right.
So you're looking at even 30, 40 miles of piping, PVC piping, plastic piping, lead piping. I mean, talk about, forget lead. What do you think they replaced the lead with?
Right.
PVC piping, vinyl, which is an endocrine disruptor. So now you have water traveling to your home, and which is going to bring me to my point of, well, what do you do about this? So, you know, it travels to your home and it gets into your glass. Whether it comes from a well, which has its own set of issues we can also go into, but a well, which is serves about, I would say, 80 million Americans, 20 to 80, depends on what part of the country, versus treatment plant water, which basically takes care of the other 250 million. They both have issues. And when they get to your glass, they have a long history. That water has a long history before it even reaches your body. So the question is, well, what do? Do you go out to restaurants and take anyone's water that ends up on the table? These are real questions that, you know, I never paid attention to either. Why would I? I just assumed it was all taken care of. And so the more I kind of peeled back the veil and saw, you know, what the real regulatory issues are. From a public health standpoint, we have a problem as well because not everyone could afford certain filtration systems, some that I recommend, but we can do pretty good. And yeah. I think that's the message. We have to tell people that bottled water has its issues.
Right. It's not just that we want to go out there and just start buying plastic bottles and drinking from that, because right. As you mentioned earlier, xenoestrogens, endocrine disruptors, all sorts of other chemicals that we probably even haven't even put the spotlight on that are causing challenges to our system.
Right.
So out of all those things, before we move on to the next topic, yeah, and we talk about action items for people in their home,
sure,
what is the practical recommendations to get the best drinking water for individuals at home?
Okay. So number one, we should all be filtering. Filtering water. And the question is, which type of filter? Because there's many. So in terms of not being limited to people who maybe are unable to afford heavy-duty systems, I actually don't want people to spend a fortune on a heavy-duty system, whole house filters,
right,
unless you feel like you can afford it and want to do that. So there's a variety of filtration systems or filters that we can think about. And there's a wonderful guide on Environmental Working Group on different types of filtration systems and how, you know, so I do refer people to that, that website. So let's just start at the most basic. We have carbon filters.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon filters are the kind you would see like on your refrigerator door, in one of the pitchers, you know, with the little drop-ins, even like on your faucet. So there's ones that sit on your faucet and the water goes through it. Based on pressure, they're limited because the water still goes pretty fast through those filters. So clearly it can't take the time to weed out all of those problems, all those chemical contaminants. It's fair. It's pretty, you know, and some of them are quite good at quite a few chemicals, but they all differ in terms of what they're able to do. So you have to read read the description from the manufacturer and certainly go to a third-party system like an EWG.
Yeah, Environmental Working Group, which is a nonprofit,
right,
has a bunch of solutions, right, that are out,
exactly,
there. And they have a bunch of filters, which I've used before too, right, that do a really good job. And you can figure out your price point.
Right. And Consumer Reports does a wonderful job of this, making sure that the filter that you buy was made in the USA. There's a lot of outsourcing of components to those filters that are tricky. You don't want the filtration portion actually from China or overseas where it's unregulated when it comes over, and have it say made in America on the box, which is what a lot of big box stores do. So you have to look into that. Also NSF certified. So there's certain certifications that Consumer Reports vets, and so you have to do your due diligence on these kind of things. But carbon filter is the most simplistic, but at least it's something. And you can even double filter. Like, say you have a pitcher and you have a refrigerator door carbon filter. So why not fill up your pitcher from the refrigerator door? So there's ways to even double filter through a carbon filter that just takes a couple extra seconds.
Yeah, the one thing that I want to say on a practical level is that whatever filter people have, if there's not an indication light or something that lets you know to change the filter, one of the biggest challenges that we see today is people forget to change their filter.
Absolutely.
And then you're exposed to even more toxins.
It can
because
push them
the
through.
Filter is,
yeah,
backed,
yeah,
up. So,
yeah,
try to look for something that at least gives you a reminder or behavior change, put in,
right,
your calendar and your app to change the filters.
That's a
regularly
great point.
It makes a huge difference. You often see it with the under the sink reverse osmosis, which is my favorite. I,
right,
really like reverse
We're
osmosis.
Gonna talk, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And can you just explain what that is?
Yeah, it's option? Reverse osmosis is really interesting because there's a lot of filters that are UV light, so they get rid of bacteria. There's distillers that are based on gravity and sort of sediment, and what kind of makes its way to the bottom is cleaner. But that doesn't take off chemicals that are like parts per billion, parts per trillion in terms
like
of their
super
quantity.
Small chemicals.
Right. So that's based on filter size. So reverse osmosis is really, in my opinion, the best and most appropriate if you can afford it. Now, they're actually in the range of $250 to $300 nowadays,
yeah,
for one filter to put under your kitchen sink and to only use it for eating, you know, for drinking and for cooking, you know, filling up your bowl for, cooking pasta or filling up your water bottle.
Or your dog's
or
dog's
your dog's
bowl, because you
got
to give
bowl.
Your dog
Trust
clean
him.
Water.
Yes. So great point, because it takes extra effort for me to do that because I have, you know, another dog and cat now. And so, I have to make an extra effort to go into those rooms and change out those water bowls.
You got to.
Thanks
got
for reminding
to.
Me. So, but, you know, the RO filter is interesting. So they are the most aggressive systems for water cleaning. And they're almost like a dialysis machine. Actually, my dad and my brother are both dialysis doctors. They're kidney doctors. So we talk a lot about how the scrutiny for water that goes back into the human body after a dialysis session is remarkable. And yet we don't think about it on an everyday basis to any human beings other than dialysis patients. And yet they're held to federal regulations and that kind of thing. So that's an aside. But RO filters have to go through 3 canisters. And then the water drips into a tank. And the reason it drips into a tank is because for water to be that cleaned, it has to go through so much surface area with specific actions of each filter. Some is sediment, then there's carbon, then there's a, so they're looking for radionucleotides like radon and microorganisms like viruses and bacteria. And then you have, the small chemicals based on molecular weight. So, phthalates and BPA and all the PFAS is all the perfluorinated chemicals that we're hearing about a lot now, like the nonstick chemicals that are sort of lingering from generations back. So that surface area matters. And so it drips into this tank, and then you get a faucet that comes up from this tank, and that is going to just tap out from the tank that you've created of water. Now, there's a sustainability question here, especially for Californians, which is water usage.
Right.
So when water goes through these RO filters, they, on average, for every 1 gallon of clean drinkable water that you create in that tank, you can lose anywhere from 3 to 5 gallons of water to make it. So my counter argument to that is that if you're only using that water for eating, drinking, baby formula, whatever you're using it for to ingest and not washing dishes.
Yeah, you're not using it for washing dishes or anything.
Then that's
like that.
An investment worth making.
Yeah. Because also in California specifically, yes, we have a water crisis that's here. And the vast majority of that is through commercial use of water. That doesn't mean I want people to waste water unnecessarily at home. But if we're talking about your longevity and the fact that there's all these chemicals that are in there, like a little bit of wasted water from individuals to protect their health is not a bad trade-off.
Absolutely.
Especially if it's going to help you stay out of the hospital system. Reduce expenses.
Yeah. I mean, by body mass index, just by body mass index and consumption, it's the number one thing the human body consumes on a daily basis.
I mean,
it's almost remarkable because we don't think about it.
Right.
But if you think about it, even more so than food, you can't live without water for 3 days, but you can live without food. Water really composes about 80% of our body tissues. And so if you're not filling that up with good stuff, you're screwed, so to speak.
Is totally true. And the other thing is that, I loved inside of your book where you really help academics understand is it's really when one time my mom went to an appointment. This was way back in the day. And she was just talking to, I was starting to just get into this material and like how to protect our home a little bit. And I was experimenting with gluten-free and dairy-free because I found out that I was sensitive. And my mom just brought a few questions back to our family doctor who's super sweet and awesome. And she was asking them, well, do we need a filter? Do we need this? And this well-meaning doctor who went to school a long time ago was saying, no, it's fine. Your body has its own ability. It's not that big of a deal. You don't need these expensive filters. One, the education wasn't what it is today. But this doctor was just doing the best to chime in on something that they weren't really aware of because they were never trained in it. They never went to school in it. So a big part of your work is educating individuals, academics, and the new book will be consumers, that this is a much bigger issue than we understand. And you mentioned EWG. They also have a section on their website where you can type in your zip code and they'll give you an idea of the chemicals that have been found in that area for your water quality. This is not just a Detroit.
By zip code. Which can be very helpful, but it can also be very scary. And I think that has to be, again, it's about education and messaging to people that, we're not all toxicologists, and certainly even doctors, medical students that are going through medical schools now, which I'm fully aware of, are not taught about anything on environmental health.
Right. And hopefully
they get 5 hours of nutrition right now.
Right.
In 4 years of med school, and that hasn't changed. I mean, that's now. Then the amount of time on curriculum they're going to spend on air pollution causing health conditions like heart disease and asthma and all those things is going to be limited as well, and certainly not practical things to do about it. Yeah. And so we're really at a point where either we have to go after this information ourselves, which is where I found myself with the dog.
Yep.
And then be frustrated enough to try to do something about it, even if it's just for your own family or your own body. So
And I think, just to interrupt for a second,
sure.
I think the point that I was making about your work and research is that people who are well-meaning, they may tell you not to worry, and we don't want anybody to worry about these things, but they may tell you, don't worry about that. It's a fad. We're just this, that. But you're presenting the education that this is affecting everyone. And if we just are smart with some simple decisions here and there, simple investment into certain things like a reverse osmosis filter or carbon filter is super easy to do. There's tools that are out there, and it can protect you for a lifetime.
Absolutely. And it pays itself off. I mean, by not schlepping home water bottles and ruining the planet with plastics. And, you know, you pay off something that's an initial investment such as that with a system. You've now created a water system, which is you're going to be using for the rest of your life. And now you have to carry it properly. So when you said BPA free bottles, actually, I don't agree with those. And most people in endocrine disruption research would argue that there's regrettable substitutions. They're now using BPS, BPFB, BPSIP. So it's like a whack-a-mole. And so if you can use glass, stainless steel, carry
ceramic,
made in America ceramic, mm-hmm. You have to be careful of that.
But the easiest and cheapest thing is glass.
Glass, and even just, you know, good stainless steel, right, that, you know, I argue should be made in the USA. But essentially, if you create a system where you're cleaning your water at home, and you're putting into reasonable containers and carrying it with you as best you can. You know, you're not going to go on vacation and necessarily, you know, take your RO filter with you. But, you know, for 80% of your exposure to water, it's controlled. You know what's in it. You've cleaned it. You know how to carry it. You can refill it at places that are now popping up in airports. There's all sorts of refillable places that may likely be using RO but could be using carbon filtration, which is fine. At least it's better than buying plastic bottles that may have been sitting in a warehouse in 100-degree weather for 6 months before it lands in your grocery store of refrigeration. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to think about where what we're doing globally for the planet, which is also by doing, you know, a system at home, you're helping the environment. You know, there are how many gallons of petroleum it goes into making one bottle, a plastic bottle. And then you're returning it back to the earth in this horrible form of a plastic bottle that's ruining, you know, the earth and, you know, the waterways. So in a way, you're doing a blessing for your body as well as for the planet. So to me, it seems like the perfect system. It just has an initial expense to set that up. Although, you know, most people would argue that's worth the expense.
Totally.
So,
you know, when we started off this podcast, we talk about a lot of different things now, but we started off this podcast, we were really focused on helping people understand about brain health. And so I'd love to take it back to that topic over here. What do we know about environmental toxins and any specific examples of how they can negatively influence the health of our brain?
So almost all of the chemicals that I'm talking about that are endocrine disruptors, do affect the brain because our systems are not closed. The human body is interconnected. The endocrine system is connected to the immune system, connected to brain function and brain health. So it's not a silo of one system versus another. So endocrine system disruptors, these chemicals, certainly play a role in brain function, whether it's from an autoimmune response, say in multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, but also, you know, in terms of anxiety and depression. We know that air pollution, for instance, which is not specifically a chemical that we can touch and feel, but it's aerated in the air, pollution can act to cause many degrees of anxiety and depression. For instance, more ER visits. When the temperature goes up and pollution levels go up, there are more ER visits related to anxiety, depression, even suicidality. Wow. So we know that our environment affects that brain chemistry. The question is, where's that exposure? Is it only air? Is it only water? Is it only personal care products? So that's one aspect.
It can come from a lot of different places, and the same thing that's not good for your hormones will also ultimately end up impacting the brain. Sure. What's some of the stuff that we know out there, especially when it comes to like certain toxins in our environment and like Parkinson's, for example?
So interesting. it's very hard, again, as I mentioned, to show any kind of causation.
Right.
So most of these studies are, at least on humans, are association. You have a much cleaner way of seeing these cause and effect when you have a lab and you're using animals that are basically sterile from environmental exposures, and you can sort of test those chemicals and hormonal effects. But extrapolating into humans is a little bit more of a leap. But that being said, Parkinson's disease, which, by the way, has been on the rise, most of the studies on many of the endocrine-related diseases, such as Parkinson's, hormone-sensitive cancers like breast, prostate, endometrial, diabetes, obesity, infertility, most of these endocrine-related diseases have been on the rise. They have been on the rise in over the last 100 years and projected to increase as well. And so that goes in line with the exposure levels that we've been seeing just globally, not just in the United States. Parkinson's disease is strongly related. Again, genetic factors contribute, right? What we're born with, but also our exposure and our lifestyle. It's a dance between these three things. But certainly pesticides are linked quite strongly to, or pesticide exposure to Parkinson's diagnosis. And turns out that there's actually ways that we can try to reduce that risk through diet. And for instance, polyunsaturated fatty acids like EPA and DHA from fish oil. Great studies showing that those who eat those fatty acids, which makes up 35% of the human brain, by the way, those fatty acids, actually contributes to lower risk of developing Parkinson's disease, and in people who have Parkinson's disease, beneficial clinical improvement. So, you know, there are actually nutritional ways to help with these exposures as well, which is another tool in the toolbox in terms of this battle. But Parkinson's is an exposure-related diagnosis. Certainly genetics are involved, and there are specific genes that have been discovered that make people more prone to that environmental.
And then like they talk about in the world of functional medicine, epigenetics, those lifestyle factors can turn those genes on or
Absolutely.
Turn those genes off. And so even if you are at a greater risk of Parkinson's or
have high exposure,
or
occupationally you're exposed to pesticides, for instance, or, you know, you're not, you know, you can help offset those risks
through a healthy life,
through healthy lifestyle, through diet, through avoidance, through behaviors such as taking off, you know, your pesticide clothing, you know, that might have been exposed and just leaving it outside. And, you know, for those who work in those industries, you know, making sure that they don't bring them in the home where your kids might be exposed, and having a separate washer and dryer, or using different times to use to wash those clothing. I mean, so you think about sort of this survey of what you do with your body every day, from what you eat to what you put on your body, to the clothes, to the fabrics, to the occupational exposures, and you start as best you can to knock those down and create healthier habits, like the tea. Back to the tea example.
Right.
You know, when you create a healthy habit that you're going to do every day, so you're a coffee drinker, a tea drinker, and this is part of your life. Like, trust me, you're a tea drinker, a coffee drinker. You know, what you want to do is make those habits healthier the best way you can, because they're at least your habits. You can work with that, right? You can have a glass teapot. You can use loose leaf tea. You can get organic versions, which certainly hold their tea leaves and exposure to a different level.
And often have bags that are made out of like organic cotton or hemp.
Right, or loose leaf, and using a stainless steel tea holder. Using a coffee mug that has no plastic. Using, in my case, organic creamer and organic cane sugar. You know, so yes, organic matters, but also the containers and food packaging that we use, we can start to make choices there, especially with habits. I say start with habits first. That's one of my recommendations. Habits are easier to wrap your head around because you do them every day. But that's a good place to start, because that's where your greatest exposure is, right? From your habits that you tend to, you know, not give up even when you travel sometimes.
So you mentioned air pollution, and I want to touch on that, because in the late 80s, the EPA came out with an analysis that found that indoor air quality can be up to 300 times more polluted than sometimes the outdoor air that we breathe. And it's our own homes, which people spend a lot of time in, that there's a lot of pollutants in. Where are these pollutants coming from? And what are the practical tips, just like with water, that we can do to help clean that air quality up inside of our homes?
So what happens in our homes is really of our own making, believe it or not, for many of the chemicals that we find ourselves living inside with. So we bring in a lot of crap. It's another place to start is get rid of all the crap we bring into our house that we think we need. Air fresheners, carpet powders, window clean. There's literally a cleaner for every nook and cranny of your house designed and marketed to you to feel like you're a slob and you need to clean up.
And I think the key there is marketed, right?
Marketed. Yeah. And if we just start thinking about simpler, nostalgic, grandma used components such as white vinegar and
baking soda
and sea salt for scrubbing, and pure lemon juice for aroma. It's amazing how much gets done with not having to buy products so you save money and not bringing in all of these untested, unlabeled, proprietary cleaning products into our lives. And just by avoiding, you save money, and you're just living in a safer environment. Because these chemicals from our surfaces end up in our dust. They end up on surfaces that we touch. They end up on our glassware. They end up in us because we brought them in. And so one of the key things is to think about, what could you really live without? Next time you go to the supermarket, do you need air fresheners? I had a whole drawer. I mean, literally, if I'd known, I would have taken a picture back in the day. I had a whole drawer of about 30 different flavored plug-ins, liquid plug-ins that you plug into the little electrical socket. I mean, every flavor as if pumpkin spice and Caribbean breeze and I think back how I was so suckered in terms of the marketing. And I realized that if you just keep a little cleaner, which is not easy when I have two kids and two animals and a husband, but when you just keep a little cleaner and you go back to very basic ingredients and you don't care as much, you sort of like take down your guard a little bit, how much less of an exposure you could possibly experience.
Yeah, because all these fragrances, which are in like every Uber now, also is like a ton of fragrances. We'll talk about that in a second. They all come from central fragrance houses. These companies buy them, almost like flavoring, all the different companies that are out there. Sometimes even organic companies that are buying flavors, they're all proprietary because these fragrance houses want to maintain the secret sauce of how they created this pumpkin spice with all these different things that they added into it. They come from these central facilities and there's no transparency on what's in it. And are you familiar at all with some of the chemicals that can end up in fragrances? Do you know any of them?
So there's so many, but as a general rule, there's a group of chemicals called phthalates, which is actually spelled P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. And phthalates, I think I'm even pronouncing it wrong, basically are a group of chemicals that were designed, they're in a lot of products, mind you. It's not just fragrance.
Right.
But they are endocrine disruptors, and they were designed to keep smells lasting longer. So they're like a preservative. They're also part of the actual smell itself in terms of just, the tones, the notes, whatever else you describe smells with, or odors, I should say. I don't really know how to describe them. Aromas. But these phthalates are actually quite pervasive. They're measurable in animal and human studies. And they are proprietary. So just like Coca-Cola, where we're not really allowed to know the ingredients, so too are these fragrances and perfumes that are now in everything from, fabric softeners and laundry detergents, to air fresheners.
Febreze, they're pretty much products that are out there.
It's amazing. And what cracks me about some of these commercials is that, they're arguing that you should have like this dirty, filthy house and spray something and walk around like you're happy about it, that you don't have to clean up. Like there's such this idea that you can skip the work and just have this stink.
Fix.
It's a quick fix, which is what we're all in, Americans, humans, myself included, we like convenience. We like quick fixes. And so it appeals to people, you know, instead of really kind of cleaning out the odors and trying to figure out what the smell is coming from, it's nice to just spritz and go.
Or if you want a pleasant smell, you could use essential oils. I mean, there's so many.
Right. And they have to be, you have to watch those too, as you know, candles, incense, essential oils. You really do need to watch those too,
make
because
sure
natural doesn't mean anything in this country. The label natural means nothing. And you can have an organic product marketed to you, not food, but a product like a detergent or a cleaner or a candle that has maybe 5% organic ingredients and 95% crap. So it won't tell you that. We have 95% crap in our product, but you have to know that the idea of organic is limited very strictly to food and much less strictly to products. You can have organic products, but there is a difference on the labeling of how much of an organic ingredient makes up that product.
So going back to air quality, because I want to just close that loop over there. Besides the stuff that we bring in and choosing better products, we're also exposed to a lot of things. Like we're in our new studio here. Mm-hmm. We used Louis here, who helps us with our podcasts and shoots them. He helped us set this up. We picked better quality paint that had low VOC, that option. That's a great option. Yeah. But we bought this new furniture. It's not like organic furniture or anything like that. It's from wherever, West Elm or anything like that.
But it's so in California. So that says something too.
Oh, tell us more.
Yeah, because what you're describing is, well, how do you fill a home with something, you know, like how do you design and be proactive about your space indoors so that it's less toxic? Well, it's
right,
one thing to be product.
Off-gassing.
Exactly. And so we, since 1975 or the 70s, we had flame retardant chemicals added to all of our puffy furniture, foam related furniture. So pretty much couches,
beds,
those kind of things. And that was, you know, the behind the scenes story on that, you know, was the Chicago Sun Times, and they did a Pulitzer Prize winning story on this and how it was sort of the same argument as the tobacco industry, that we needed these chemicals in our couches. If someone were to drop a cigarette on the couch, you would have 12 seconds of burn time before it would go up in flames and you would die. So you had 12 seconds to leave the house. Literally, this is the story of flame retardant chemicals. And it was all set up by the tobacco industry because they didn't want to reformulate their cigarettes. So there was a huge push, marketing, lawyers, lobbyists, you name it. And so it became a thing to put brominated flame retardants. Now they have all different versions, Tris. There's a whole slew of flame retardant chemicals that are brominated or fluorinated. And the problem with those chemicals is because bromine and fluorine actually live forever. So we have these persistent chemicals now in our environment, even though in 2013, California did right by themselves because it started in California and pushed across the country, but then they reverted, they changed that law. So now it's up to the manufacturers to take those chemicals out, which is a good thing because it is starting to work across all the furniture manufacturers. But those chemicals are not linked to the materials they're infiltrated in, plastics and the fabrics. So they come off. They fall off into our environment, into our home environment.
On our clothes, on our skin, you're laying down
and
the
dust.
Couch and your hair, dust.
So there have been great studies on dust. I mean, wonderful studies on dust showing how many chemicals are really in our home, and they end up in these dust balls. And if you measure these chemicals, phthalates, flame retardant chemicals, and pesticides in dust, it's remarkable. So that comes from someplace. It comes from flame retardants in our technology, and our computers have casings that are flame retardant. They're infused into the plastics. They're in cables, all our cables, right? So they don't blow up on us if there's an electrical fire. Furniture, but we also have other chemicals, like I said, from cleaning, from air fragrance. Certain furnitures have glues and epoxy resins and formaldehyde that can eventually get off of those products. So the sum of it is, A, you can't always afford to get rid of couches. So we had 3 couches and it took us like 5 years. Even though I knew the problems, we didn't have the money to just toss a couch for $3,000.
And also, too, sometimes the longer you've had it,
right,
some of that exposure has already been kind of taken off a little bit, not in a good way or a bad way. It may not be to go get a completely new couch.
If nowadays you can read the label.
Okay, got
it.
And
so these are the things that I post, and I teach doctors, and I teach high school students, and I teach anyone who will listen, that we now have labeling that shows which product from which manufacturing group has removed those chemicals.
And are those labels pretty easy to read, or are they like confusing as hell, like most labels?
Well, they're great question. I don't think they're easy for the average person. I don't think people know to even look. In other words, if you don't know there's a problem, you don't bother to look.
So are you saying that pretty much anywhere in the States, you go and you buy a mattress, and on that label, you can see all the...
It'll say made with flame retardant chemicals or complies with... So, for instance, if it says TB... 117, which was actually the bill back in the 1970s, dash 2013, when this changeover happened, you know that this is likely not to have flame retardant chemicals because of that 2013. If it doesn't have that 2013 and just says complies with TB117, that likely has the flame retardant chemicals because they were trying to comply with the legislation at the time.
And I know you're an academic, so giving specific recommendations, you know, you want to stay neutral and just put the highlight on the research. Are there other resources out there, just like you pointed at EWG, that might show, for instance, like if somebody's in the market for a new mattress,
right? Yeah,
where can they find like the best things? Because you're talking about TB 17, that sort
of
thing.
Yeah, yeah. So
people can get a little lost.
So there's a fabulous researcher named Arlene Bloom. Blum or Bloom, I'm not sure if I got it right. I hope I don't offend anyone. But she was basically the fabulous researcher, the academic who helped get flame retardant chemicals out of pajamas from those 1970 regulations that happened. They were actually putting flame retardant chemicals in kids' pajamas so that they wouldn't, if there was a fire in the house, that they wouldn't burn. Turns out that they didn't do much and, in fact, created a whole several generations of kids that had high levels of flame retardant chemicals in their blood. Her story is remarkable, but she also went on to do quite a bit of work at UC Berkeley, and she's written books, and she has a website that is also, she's a nonprofit, Green Science Policy. And in that, her resources, she gives lists of manufacturing groups that have taken out flame retardant chemicals. And you know, so she's a great resource for the concept of flame retardant chemicals and how they've evolved and what to know about them, how to read labels, and certainly how to buy a couch moving forward. So I defer to her quite a bit from her work.
Yeah, and as consumers are starting to change their voting with their dollar, more and more startups are coming out. I mean, you got to vet them and make sure that they're actually doing what they say they're doing. Like I saw an organic mattress company the other day, you know, and that was really highlighting and saying these are the chemicals that we don't have. This is how we make the product.
No such thing as an organic mattress.
Well, by
by regulation, it's like organic. Yeah. I'm trying to give you an idea.
Yeah, totally. So
that there's marketing with organic dry cleaners.
So it could be organic cotton, like top layer.
It could be one piece of it.
Just talking about that.
Right.
And but they did list all the chemicals that are typically in mattresses that they avoid. And you know, it'd be great to see if this...
No, I think that's a really important thing because if they're going to the effort, you'd like to believe that if they're going to the effort to really label what they don't have, and there must be third-party testing, but you have to explore. As an educated consumer, you really have to do your due diligence. When we bought a new mattress, I called Arlene. I had to contact all these different people because I myself couldn't figure it out. And, you know, there are certifications, there are third body testers, but you always want to do your due diligence, whatever big purchase you're going to make. I mean, any purchase, but big purchases, especially mattresses, couches, and put some thought in flooring. I mean, just even putting in vinyl flooring can be a real problem. Vinyl is not good for human health. And you want to think about those levels of heavy metals that are in flooring. So it's a process, and I'm not in any way minimizing it because I've been through it myself. But it just means be smart and go to the good resources. And I think most people will make their way through this maze.
Well, maybe one day when you're fully out of academia, you can just give an exact list of everything that people should buy. And we can just hit the one-click button and get it all.
It may happen. You never know.
You never know. You know, you've talked about different demographics where people especially, you know, we don't want to get overwhelmed by these things, but we do want to pay attention. We want to be smart about them. But there can be different ages of development where chemicals can have the biggest impact on us. High level, can you chat about some of these either communities or ages that people hit, regardless of what community they're from, where chemicals can sometimes have the maximum impact, where we need to put a little extra attention?
Yeah. So this was, again, part of my learning curve over the past 8 years. Didn't know this was even a thing. But we have, you know, certainly developmental periods during human growth and development, you know, that are more vulnerable to chemicals than others. And I didn't know that it was even true. But if you think about it, all of the biggest developmental periods, so certainly in utero, so a fetus, right? So a fetus has enormous amount of growth and development. Brain development, 250,000 neurons are created per minute during an entire pregnancy. It's pretty shocking. And that makes it the brain very vulnerable. So those exposures in utero during a pregnancy are very important in terms of exposures, to any number of exposures. So air quality even, and not just chemicals and foods and drinking water. Then another large or important period is toddlers or young children, because they're growing, again, exponentially, hormonally, physically, their brain development, you know, so that's a very, you know, important window of exposure. Then you move up to sort of the teenage years, adolescence, kind of age 9 to 18, is another big window. Hormones, right? This is why I'm getting into work with high school students, because they're teeming with hormones, right? And that's a period whenever there's hormonal change is where many of these chemicals, not all of them, but many of these chemicals, particularly the endocrine disrupting chemicals, can have effect.
There's even some thoughts that some of these environmental toxins could be, in addition to other factors that are out there, food could be part of the reason that we're seeing some young women having their periods much, much, much earlier than they might normally have it.
And that is true. And particularly in the African-American community, African-American girls. So all, you know, we've been shifting our menarche or the first onset of periods or menstrual periods for generations. I mean, it used to be 2 generations, 3 generations ago, young girls were on average getting their periods at age 16 or 15, even a couple hundred years ago, that we can record or that we have evidence of. It has now gotten to the point where young girls are starting to menstruate as early as 7, 8, 9. And the reason that's a problem is because when women are exposed to estrogen, starting at such a young age and usually finishing their periods in their 50s, that's a long period of time for estrogen exposure, which increases their risk of breast cancer and other endocrine-sensitive hormones that are sensitive to estrogen. Combining that, you know, and it's believed to be related to, but combining that with hormone disrupting chemicals that may influence and mimic estrogen, it becomes a real problem.
My own mother had had breast cancer a few years ago. Luckily, she's doing great and worked with the doctors at our clinic at the Ultra Wellness Center, Dr. Liz Bohm and a few other doctors. She had a specific type of breast cancer where she tested positive for the HER2 positive gene, which is an estrogen dominant cancer. And in the education of that and working with the great physicians that were out there and researchers, including Ralph Moss, who was previously at Sloan Kettering, he was saying that all these environmental factors and these xenoestrogens and endocrine disruptors, because you have this gene, they can make you more likely to have this type of particular cancer. So we need to pull back. We don't want you microwaving using plastic anymore. We don't want you doing these things. We want you to stay away from these fragrances. We want you eating a diet that supports these aspects. So In my own family, I've seen how
that. And I think more and more of us have family members that are affected by all sorts of health conditions. Breast cancer is now moving towards 1 in 8. When I was growing up, it was 1 in 15. You could argue it's better detection, perhaps, maybe better awareness, but the science is showing that it's environment driven, along with, of course, the, you know, susceptible genes. So Ashkenazi Jews and BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. I mean, we are now seeing, and we're getting better with this, I think, as the science is moving forward, which is great in terms of gene studies. We're seeing which population may be more susceptible to which kind of exposure. My argument and what I try to think about when I post and teach is that we should all be doing these things, that we shouldn't really be relying on whether you have a gene that makes you susceptible and I don't, like, or the APOE4 gene for Alzheimer's, for instance. The recommendations, I think, for someone who has dominant genes, too dominant, you know,
APOE4?
Thank you. Genes or not, is that we should all be having these behaviors that are able to reduce those exposures, because we don't know what we got ultimately. You might have that gene, but you don't have this gene.
And even if you do know, just like you said earlier, the body is not these isolated silos. Right. Everything affects everything.
Absolutely.
And just because we don't have the research that we might have some research that these heavy metals or these environmental toxins might be linked to Parkinson's, but maybe in a few years more, we find out that they're also linked to these other diseases too.
Right. And using the precautionary principle, which you talked about, which is basically saying that even if we don't have direct cause and effect evidence that this causes this, we, based on the evidence, whether it's animal studies or just reasonable information and logic, it makes sense to avoid that. I mean, that's what precautionary principle was, describes. It talks about the fact that there's not exact cause and effect evidence. You could still make a good decision based on the available evidence. And a lot of the recommendations I make don't have multi-million-dollar double-blinded placebo studies behind them.
And even if they did, it's
like
actually
tea.
Very
well, it's, you know, like
tough,
as simple
right?
as
gonna
that.
Fund it?
Who's going to fund it? Thank God we have this, this new study that talks about, tea bags and how it's influencing microplastics in our cup of tea every morning or coffee or what have you. But, I would argue that once you get good at sort of removing these exposures on some level, you kind of build up some momentum to your process, you start to realize that you don't really need a lot of this stuff, and you're going to save yourself a lot of other medical problems, not just the one you might have the genes for.
And you're going to help the environment as well.
Absolutely.
Other factors. What's your message with the work that you're doing out here right now? You want to leave people with something. This can feel like a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It can feel like, how do we navigate it? What's the message and the sense of hope? Because you shared something earlier. You said, I really don't want to overwhelm people, but we do want to pay attention because we're trying to protect ourselves. What's the central message you want to tell people and leave people with when it comes to your work in this crazy environmental storm of environmental toxins that we're all in?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is we're all on a journey. At least I was on a journey. I'm still on a journey. I still color my hair. And these are things that I call myself out on. I mean, there are habits that we all have that we either really like or don't want to give up or haven't figured out another solution for. I think what you do is you pick the low-hanging fruit. You pick the stuff that is really easy just to either avoid in your life or not buy in your life, that's just extra stuff. And you start working on the low-hanging fruit that's easy and accessible, and you work your way through all of your behaviors or any exposures that you can control. So when I think about overwhelming people or being overwhelmed myself, and again, this has been a journey for me for about 8, 9, 10 years, I actually like to call in the Serenity Prayer. I actually have it posted in my exam rooms in my office, which basically I'll state it. It says, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I think the value of that prayer in terms of this topic of environmental health and exposure is that we can't do it all, but we should know what we can control. We can't always control the air quality when we step out our door, but we can control what's in our home. We can control what we bring into our home. We can open our windows for a half an hour a day, assuming that the air quality outdoor is better than the indoor. We can dust regularly. We can get an air filter. You can get an air filter, especially with kids that are, have asthmatic children in
families. Especially the room that we sleep in. I think that's very important, is that the room that you're in, that you sleep in, that you spend 8 hours a night when your body's in DNA repair, it's going through all this process, detoxification. It's nice to have, besides the fact that it's very soothing for me to hear that like white noise that's there, same thing that we give to babies, it's very soothing to adults. It actually is making sure that at night when you're breathing and you're spending that time in the room, you're getting clean air.
No, absolutely. And so that's an environment you can control. Start with what you can control, your home. Sometimes it's your workplace. Even if it's some place where you have a say in who does the cleaning and what products they use. I mean, I spend money on my own products, even if we have a cleaning service in our office, because I want those chemicals that air off to be non-toxic. So these little changes that you add into your controllable space, which you how you do your tea in the morning, your coffee, how you carry your water, the couches you buy, the fabrics that you buy, whether they're nonstick or say Gore-Tex or waterproofing chemicals, or if you choose to stain guard or not your couch, which I recommend not. Those are the places that you have control over. And I think a lot of this messaging and why we feel so stressed when we come to this topic is that we feel out of control. We feel like we don't have the ability to make our lives safer. And my job, the Smart Humans job, and platform is really to show us that we can, and that the studies show that if you make these changes, you can lower those exposures, blood levels go down. If you choose different personal care products, like they did with the Hermosa study, where they had 100 Latina girls change out their personal care products for 3 days and measured those blood and urine levels and found a remarkable drop in those chemicals in their bodies.
That's huge.
And there's many of these studies. And I'm trying to show physicians and high school students and community lectures that we can have control. You have to just pick the areas that you do have control and not get overwhelmed by, you know, highway pollution, which you can't always control. And you have to drive on the highway. You can get an air filter in your car, but you can't always fix the air quality. You know, drinking water, again, I'm taking that control back to my own life by choosing how to clean my water, how to carry my water. And that's worth my expense for me. And you have to judge based on your own family's needs and what your value system is. But it's a journey and it's not easy. But when you do one thing at a time, maybe once a month, you start to see that your life shifts and you have a better perspective and you feel in control of those changes.
Mm, well said. So you created this website, you've mentioned a couple of times, The Smart Human. Tell us what it is. And also for listeners who really dug this podcast and want to dig a little deeper, any few articles or content that you've posted on there that's a good natural step to begin digging down the rabbit hole of The Smart Human?
So thesmarthuman.com, as I mentioned, came out of a place of frustration where I just really needed to start sharing what I learned at the most basic level. And it's really evolved into a place where I put articles that I'm involved with, whether it's drinking water or pregnancy and what to know when you're in a pregnancy, in terms of environmental exposures to a fetus and how to choose better on those levels, podcasts that I think are very simple. And I'm really talking to everyday people about everyday choices. And that's the market I'm trying to reach. People who may not have enormous finances, people who have no science background, maybe people who have fourth grade education and below. That's okay, because we can all make those changes, you know, independent of all of those factors. And I want people just to know how to locate the resources, the references, the websites that are appropriate, and just make sure it's really solid information, not branded, not, you know, politically influenced. I don't endorse anything. It's squeaky clean because I'm working to really get this into high schools nationally as a curriculum.
So the book that you have out right now, we're going to have you back on the podcast when your next book comes out. Is that a deal?
Deal.
And we're going to go deep into a bunch of other topics. I really actually want to go super deep into like makeup and, you know, there's so much of the marketing I feel is disproportionately focused on women. And all these solutions, and whether it's makeup or personal care products, and you're talking about tampons and other things that are out there, feminine hygiene, there's just so much bombarded on women and so much targeted on women that I feel like we could do an entire episode just on
Absolutely.
That
yeah.
and all the chemicals that are in it. So I'm excited to have you back. But in the meantime, there's a book that you've written for academics. It's a textbook, but can everyday people buy it too? Like people that are listening to this podcast who aren't afraid of the science and want to dig in a little bit further, can they get it?
Right. Yeah. So the way it was designed, so this book is actually the 13th book in the series that was created through Dr. Andrew Weil, who's my mentor, and I trained with him.
And for those that are not, for those that are listening and not watching on video, it's the Integrative Environmental Medicine textbook.
And so this textbook, so there's a wonderful series. So there's Integrative Men's Health and Integrative Women's Health and Integrative Cardiology, Integrative Pediatrics. So this is the Integrative Environmental Medicine text in this series. And, you know, I created it with Dr. Frederick von Saal, who is the guy who got BPA out of baby bottles and, you know, sports bottles, and has been working tirelessly his whole life as an emeritus professor on the understandings of BPA and how it affects human health and wildlife. So he and I put this together, but essentially we have 26 of the most incredible toxicologists, environmental scientists, physicians. There's 26 contributing authors, including myself, with the last chapter, which is the proactive approaches to handling all of these exposures. So there's a chapter on drinking water. There's a chapter on the gut microbiome, written by one of your other podcast guests.
Dr. Marvin Singh.
Dr. Marvin Singh did a wonderful job. That's how I got to know him. So they did a chapter with Dr. Jerry Mullen on the microbiome and how that's affected by environmental exposures. There's a whole chapter on food additives. But what my vision was when I first approached Dr. Vamsal was, yes, it's a textbook. Yes, it's written by a wonderful group, Oxford University Press, but it has to have meaning and value to proactive changes. It has to have, it has to offer a solution, not just the problem. So what was not so easy was really getting some of these bench scientists to make their own recommendations at the end of each chapter, which is filled with studies and, you know, from the NIH and World Health Organization. I mean, it's just loaded with great science. But what I wanted at the end of each chapter was a real practical list. It was like pulling teeth from some of them, but because they're not comfortable with that arena. But we got it. We got great recommendations in each at the end of each chapter for how to handle cell phone radiation and technology. Dr. Deborah Davis, you know, drinking water recommendations, food quality recommendations, and how to choose your food and clean your food properly. So it's a textbook, but it's kind of a hybrid because for people who can get through some of the science but really get to the recommendations, including my chapter, which is, you know, kind of filled with all sorts of ideas and resources, it's usable and it's available and usable to pretty much anyone who can, I would say, 8th, 10th grade education and above. So,
and just a little preview on the next book that comes out, Non-Toxic Guide to Living Healthy in a Chemical World. So that's next year. It's going to be out. We're going to have you back on the podcast then. Just a little preview. This is the how-to manual for individuals at home that they can follow. My question for you is, and the answer is probably no, but will you have specific products that you recommend that you actually use inside of there?
No.
But you will give us places where we can go that other people
can. Yeah, I'm going to give you resources that are very, you know, regarded. Yes.
See, highly regarded. It's like pulling teeth from you. I'm trying to get
but I can explain why.
I'm
trying to really make sure that this information lives on at a level where teenagers are able to, adolescents and teenagers are able to get into these habits, make healthier choices, have the resources and the tools to really learn what they buy, what they put in, on, and around their bodies, and to get into schools and to really make those academic relationships with major universities that I'm working with right now.
Yeah, and to do that, you have to stay away from making specific recommendations.
And that's more important.
I'm teasing
to
you a little bit, the same way that you probably were dealing with the doctors.
I'd love to scream on top of mountains, you know, of some
but
of the products.
I'm sure there's places that you recommend that people can go. For our listeners that want to find you, follow you, and keep in touch with you, where can they find you online?
So thesmarthuman.com is the platform for my website where I kind of hold on to everything from podcasts or, you know, written articles. Then Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook is thesmarthuman or at thesmarthuman. And then, of course, I practice in Princeton, New Jersey, and my website for that is just Ailey, AlyCohenMD.com, if anyone wants to visit me. But essentially, you know, I really want this to be a legacy, for this to be a real tool for people to not be resistant to change and to take on this individual issue, you know, with grace and not be stressed, but to do it in a reasonable way.
And when we vote with our free speech and our dollar, I mean, these companies are listening. You know,
absolutely.
There's a big shift that's
happening
now.
Market is changing.
Sometimes it's not always genuine products that are out there, but at least the market is listening and they're heading. And social media is a great tool for voicing, sharing, and giving information without overwhelming people or being necessarily having to be an evangelist for it, but just saying, hey, I used to use this and now I use this. And these companies are all paying attention to that. You know, they're very much paying attention to that.
Right.
Dr. Cohen, thank you for coming on the Broken Brain Podcast and educating our listeners on this important topic of environmental toxins. We'll put all the links that you talked about to The Smart Human, the books that are out, and your Instagram and social media inside the show notes. But more importantly than anything, just want to say thank you for the advocacy and the work that you're doing to really educate people and have them be empowered consumers.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.